the spiritual migration. What do you say about that?
Yeah, people who choose to leave that state they're already in are choosing to move mentally, right?
Yeah,
or choosing to move spiritually. Where they are, they're not comfortable. They want to move. They want to change where they are, right?
Yes.
Mentally, spiritually, wherever they are. So it does exist. Certain people might move.
But do you think it would work?
What would?
Migrating from one habit to another.
One habit to another. As long as you find out what's causing you to be inhabituated to that certain thing, it might be helpful. If you just want to replace a certain thing with another just as bad, then, you might...
You're
just
not doing
stick
a
to the
very
first thing,
job.
Right?
Yeah.
So there's no progress. There's no growth, right?
So I guess as human beings, we're doing that on a daily basis. What do you say?
Certain people do. Certain people don't. For example, you're never static. You always move.
That's
right?
It. Yeah.
Either you're growing or
we're
you're falling
characters.
Down.
Yeah.
Either you're inclining or you're reclining, but there is movement. Uh-huh. Nothing is still.
It's going to be very. Nice and very good of us to ponder upon the reasons of migrations of Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Imam Hussein alayhi salam's migration, his movement, this is my opinion as far as I've seen and read, is that Imam alayhi salam's migration, spiritual to be specific, wasn't solely or only for himself. His migration was the migration of a nation, spiritual migration.
That is what we mean, spiritual migration.
Of a complete nation. His movement was what triggered and awakened the spirit.
Such a man moving from his hometown, coming to a different place for plenty much of reasons that are mostly... for the benefit of human beings, not only himself.
Yeah.
It is something very great.
It's completely because of the human beings. Through and during that process, certainly, there's an immense amount of spiritual elevation that Imam alayhi salatu wasalam goes through.
Yeah.
It was a cause of awakening within an entire nation. That was there at that time, in that place, and beyond that time, and beyond that place.
Yeah.
As we just mentioned, there are people who get awakened in this day and age after hundreds of years, over 1,000 years, only
because...
That's
very strange,
a strength.
Because, you know, every year you go through the same story, it must be something repetitive. Why
it
doesn't
be.
Why it doesn't lose its I don't know why
its
we
charm
do,
it's got this the power that it has
exactly
we tend you know there are two ways to go around it. Either we tend to go rusty right, and at the end of the year when Muharram returns we
it kind
get
of
polished.
Purifies ourselves
we get polished we refined.
That's very true.
And, those people who tend to keep themselves polished throughout the year, they keep on growing. They explore dimensions of their own personality through Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam.
You know, everyone according to their capacity, when they intern the month of Muharram, they would get something out of it. And each year as you just go through it, it feels like something new has happened to you. It's not just like the year you passed. You know what I mean? I mean, there would be a growing each year after you go through this month.
Yeah, because you're alive. Life has to grow. Where there's life, there's growth. Yeah?
Yeah.
And the reason why Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam leaves the city of Medina is because of this. People were dead inside, right? How do you know people are dead? He points it out. He's like, what did he say? He says that, do you not see that what's true, what's, you know, the rightfulness is not being practiced upon?
Exactly.
Right? And do you not see that falsehood, no one's standing up against falsehood, right?
Yeah.
That is a sign of a dead society.
Yes, that's very true.
Right. Yeah.
So from a dead society, you have to migrate in order to make it complete.
Yeah. From that society,
yeah.
Firstly, we need to, as individuals, wake up.
Yeah.
Find some life within ourselves, right? Even if I do not see wrong happening around me, which is very rare in this time and age, right?
Exactly,
there's certainly something wrong
there
happening.
There must be something wrong.
Within my family, within myself, I'm an oppressor maybe, you know, like I'm doing something wrong with my siblings, my parents, my spouse, whatever it is, my children, right?
Yeah.
But even if that's not the case, there's so much positive, there's so much righteousness out there that I myself as an individual am not practicing.
Yeah.
When I'm not practicing that, I am no one to blame the society.
Yes.
So I have to be an individual who's alive.
So every single one of us has to go through that moment of awakening and then start thinking that there's something wrong that has to be corrected.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
We were just talking about the migration of Imam Hussein alayhi salam to Karbala and the story of Ashura. We would say that because this migration has got so much of reasons behind it, it will never fade away. And each year, as you start to think about it, you would bring out some new factors, new reasons of why he did such a great journey into a place in which he's going to be martyred.
The beauty of Karbala and the beauty of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam is this, that any person in any time, in any person in any time and age of any age can relate to them, right? Mm-hmm. And each stage of your life, right, you might relate to a certain personality who was near Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam during the event of the advent of Karbala, right?
Yes.
You're not, you're not a mother yet, right?
Yes.
Or you're not a father yet, right? At that time, you were a youth, right?
Yes.
You're related to what? Ali Akbar alayhi salam.
Yes.
Right? Now you've grown into a mid-aged man or a woman. You've got a young child. And now you can relate to the pain.
So it has got many examples for different ages.
Yeah. And that why is the beauty of Ahlul Bayt is this. The Prophet, peace be upon him, he taught us so many things. He taught and he showed us so many things.
Of course.
There were so many other things that he did teach us, but it was absolutely impossible for him to show us. How so? Being a mother, could he show us how to be a mother?
Mm-hmm.
No. He's a man. He's a father, right?
Yeah.
It's impossible to show him, for him to show us how to be a mother.
The passion of a mother,
His Ahlul Bayt, they show us.
Exactly. Because he's the father of the Ummah, of course, of his people, of the nation that is related to him. Dear listeners, I hope you're not tired. Let's go for a short break. We'll be back in no time. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned. We're coming back. so we were talking about the great migration of Imam Hussein alayhi salam to Karbala, and we said that there are plenty of factors and reasons behind this spiritual journey. It's a kind of a journey that would never lose its effects on the people who are actually pondering over it. And it has got so much of examples for different ages. And we also mentioned so much of the factors and reasons that why Imam Hussein alayhi salam took this journey.
We also learned that it's never too late.
Yeah, of course.
Hud alayhi salam at that time. It was it's never too late.
Yes, yes. That actually is a very interesting thing you mentioned. Just as one of the companions of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, as you mentioned, Hur, he was actually a bit of late, but then...
Yeah, that's the whole point. It's never too late.
It's never too late.
Yeah, it's never too late.
It was late, but never too late because...
Although he was the reason why Imam was there in the first
exactly.
place. Exactly. But, you know, it's never too late.
So any moment that you're going through is going to be a chance for you to turn it all around.
Naturally, we've got this in our mind that, you know, I've committed so many sins. I've strayed away so far. Then there's no
And there's no way
back.
For me to be forgiven.
Yeah. That's the biggest lie.
Because God himself tells us all the time in the Holy Book of Quran that the greatest sin is to be hopeless from my forgiveness.
Yeah. Having no hope in his forgiveness.
So thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us. This was all the time that we had for today's episode. Thank you for choosing us. Until another session, I bid you farewell.
If you did not choose us, you better choose us.
Yes, there's no other way for you. And I will leave you to the never slipping eyes of God.
Inshallah, we'll see you in Karbala. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullah.
I have what I have. My love is strong. Because of you, in weakness I am braver. My defender and my savior. My giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance. Aware when I need you, the light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love, my love. Strong because you are the one I call creator, my alpha and omega, my protector and my maker, because of you.
In the limelight. Israel, the world's eighth largest nuclear power, initiated its nuclear program in 1952 with technological support from France and the United States of America, the two countries most vocal about Iran's peaceful nuclear program. Today, the Israeli regime possesses over 90 nuclear warheads with enough plutonium to produce at least 200 nuclear weapons. We now present you an article written by Scott Ritter, a former U.S. Marine Corps intelligence officer. The piece is titled, Ehud Barak's Empty Threat. Please stay with us for more of Scott Ritter's article. Ehud Barak, the former prime minister of the Israeli regime, recently published an opinion piece in Time, where he concludes that Iran could be days away from reaching what he terms threshold nuclear status, namely possessing enough enriched uranium to manufacture a single nuclear device. Ehud Barak acknowledges that even if Iran were to accumulate the required stock of enriched uranium to cross this threshold, it would still need 18 to 24 months to polish their skills treating metal uranium and packing it into a missile warhead. According to Barak, this is a mere technicality which Iran can overcome at any time. Barak contends Iran is about to cross the point of no return in becoming a member of the nuclear club. Left unsaid by Barak is the fact that Israel is itself a member of this club, having built a nuclear weapons program outside the framework of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT, which the Zionist regime has not joined. It seems that hypocrisy knows no bounds. Israel, the world's eighth largest nuclear power, initiated its clandestine nuclear program in 1952 with technological support from France and the United States, the two countries most vocal about Iran's peaceful nuclear program. According to military think tanks, the first nuclear weapons were developed by Tel Aviv regime somewhere around 1967-1968. After that, the production accelerated rapidly, with zero internal outcry. Today, the regime possesses over 90 nuclear warheads with enough plutonium to produce at least 200 nuclear warheads. Around 5 kilograms of weapons-grade plutonium is required for one nuclear bomb. What has emboldened the Tel Aviv regime to accelerate its nuclear activities while wrapping a cloak of secrecy around them is Western sponsorship made possible by Zionist lobbying groups in the United States and Europe. The two countries most critical of Iran's nuclear program are Israel's staunchest allies, who helped the regime become a nuclear power. Israel's weapons-grade fissile material stocks originated in France in the 1960s, and the United States in the late 1960s. There has always been a difference between capability and intent when assessing Iran's nuclear ambitions. For its part, Iran has consistently maintained that while it seeks to master the nuclear fuel cycle, inclusive of large-scale enrichment of uranium, it does not intend to use this capability for military purposes. Indeed, Iran has linked this policy to the core foundation of what it stands for as a nation, its Islamic faith. The Islamic Republic of Iran has had two supreme leaders in its history, Ayatollah Sayyid Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, and Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, both of whom have made it clear, through their words and deeds, that a nuclear weapon is anathema to their Islamic beliefs, and as such forbidden under Islam as practiced in Iran. The West might be dismissive of such public posturing by the national leaders, having grown accustomed to the common practice of its own leaders to say one thing and do another. However, in a nation such as Iran, where religious leaders are empowered by their respective hozas or seminary followings to issue fatwas or religious decrees derived from their juristic beliefs as expressed through a published Risala Amaliya, or mutual of practical applications of their religious beliefs as they apply to society, the concept of a leader attaching religious significance to a decision only to do something else is unthinkable. We'll be right back. while the United States of America, during the Obama administration, did make passing reference to the importance of the fatwa or religious decree issued by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, about nuclear weapons, its policies never reflected that this understanding was anything more than superficial. A throwaway line used to distract from policies designed to undermine Iran rather than promote its nuclear energy ambitions. Meanwhile, the Israeli regime has maintained from the start that Iran is pursuing a nuclear weapons program and has gone so far as to define nuclear weapons capability as being linked to the existence of a viable uranium enrichment capability, since, using Israeli logic, a nuclear weapon cannot exist without such capacity. In his opinion article, Ehud Barak ignores the role played by Israel in manufacturing a case against Iran regarding its nuclear intent. Ehud Barak denigrates the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, the nuclear agreement between Iran, Russia, China, Germany, the United Kingdom, France, the European Union, and lastly, the United States, finalized in July of 2015, in which Iran agreed to unprecedented restrictions and monitoring inspections in exchange for having economic sanctions linked to its nuclear program lifted, as failing to go far enough to limit Iran's peaceful nuclear capabilities. Ehud Barak ignores the fact that, as part of this agreement, the international community with Iran's cooperation thoroughly investigated a dossier of allegations regarding Iran's military intent when it comes its nuclear programs that had been assembled primarily based upon Israeli intelligence, key aspects of which turned out to be pure fabrication, and found these accusations to be wanting. Seen in this light, the restrictions imposed on Iran by the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, were based upon the reality of its civilian nuclear program, as opposed to the malign fantasy being promulgated by Israel. And while Ehud Barak decries the decision by the United States to withdraw from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, in 2018, his chief complaint is that neither the United States nor Israel prepared a Plan B for this eventuality. A large-scale military strike targeting the totality of Iran's nuclear infrastructure. Ehud Barak's solution isn't to find a way to work with Iran to create confidence in the international community regarding Iranian intent, but rather to focus on preparing sufficient military capability so that Israel would be able to eliminate Iranian nuclear capability altogether with a unilateral strike. This, of course, is no solution at all. Importantly, and quite scandalously, the Israeli regime is not the signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT. It has repeatedly rejected calls to join the Keystone Accord of the International Arms Control Regime and refused to give United Nations Nuclear Agency, the IAEA inspectors, access to its nuclear sites. Despite the Israeli regime's dismissive approach, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, has adopted a remarkably soft approach to the point that many see collusion between the two. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi's recent whirlwind trip to Tel Aviv, ahead of the United Nations Nuclear Agency's Board of Governors meeting in Vienna, lent credence to the plausible Israel-IAEA collusion theory. Rafael Grossi dashed off to Israel to discuss the anti-Iran resolution drafted by the United States and the European Troika with Israeli officials, aimed at mounting pressure on Iran to give up its legitimate demands. Does it make sense that the IAEA chief meets the head of an illegitimate regime which has secretly built a nuclear arsenal and refused to cooperate with the United Nations agency, the IAEA, to discuss the nuclear program of a country that has signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT, cooperated fully with the agency and fulfilled all of its obligations. It smells of something deeply sinister and extremely despicable. Therefore, the West must accept the inevitability of Iran's nuclear ambition, limited in scope as it is to purely civilian purposes, and inclusive of a uranium enrichment capability derived from its mastering of the nuclear fuel cycle in its entirety. This program can either be monitored by the international community in accordance with the provisions contained within the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, or in a less intrusive manner per Iran's existing obligations under the NPT. The choice is the West to make. Either way, however, Iran will exercise its rights under the NPT to pursue a peaceful civilian nuclear program. And no amount of threats from either Israel or the United States can stop this.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle.
Today's lesson, Ethics of Salam and Greeting. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the ethics of saying salam and greeting each other when we see each other in the Islamic lifestyle. When we see the Islamic text, we see that there are specific ethics that when two groups or maybe two people are seeing each other, they meet each other, how they should say the greetings and who should say the greetings first, and what is the best thing to perform or do. In that, we see that the first thing, first ethic is, it is said that whenever two people see each other and we see that there is a youngster meeting an oldest person or maybe someone who is older in age, it is said that the smallest should say salam to the oldest. Young generation should say salam to the old generation. And therefore we see that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, يُسَلِّمُ الصَّغِيرُ عَلَى الْكَبِيرُ. Whenever a small person, for example, like the one who's in age, smaller, he must say salam to the kabir, to the old age. وَالْمَارُ عَلَى الْقَاعِدُ. And the one who is passing from somewhere and he sees there's a group or someone who's sitting next to him, when he's passing from there, he should say salam to those who are sitting. وَالْقَلِيلُ عَلَى الْكَثِيرُ. And a small group, when they meet a great group, they must say salam to that big group. So this is from the ethics. The first ethic is that Imam Sadiq has said that the youngsters must say salam to the older, and the one who is passing or is walking in the street and he sees that there is a group of people who are standing maybe, or there are some people are sitting, he must say salam to them. So inshallah, when we see our older, when we see our youngsters, even when we see people sitting in the mosque or the street, standing in the street or sitting somewhere. So when we pass, inshallah, we say salam. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the ethics of greeting and saying salam. We said that when a smaller sees a bigger, they must say salam. It means that if is a younger, he should say salam to the oldest. If the person is walking, he should say to the ones who are sitting. If there is a small group, they should say salam to the big group. On the other hand, the second thing that we have is that we should say salam in a way that the other person can hear what we have said. And this is from the slogans of Islam, that the saying salam is the slogan of Islam, that the Muslims, when they meet each other, they say salam to each other. And they pray for each other when they see each other. So the second thing is that when we say salam, it should be in a way so that the person whom we said salam to him, he must hear what we have said. And we should say salam to everyone so that it is, because it is a slogan. The third thing in Islam is from the ethics is that we should answer people in a proper way. For example, if someone has come to us and said salam, even in a small, in a lower tone, we should meet him in a way with the energy so that he gets warmer or he gets a good feeling from our answer. So whenever we need to answer the one who has said salam, obviously it should be in a way so that they can hear us and they know that we have answered it. The fourth thing is that the answer of the salam should be equal to what they have said. For example, if someone says salam, you just say salam to him. If someone has said assalamu alaykum, you answer wa alaykum assalam. If someone has said salamun alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, you must answer wa alaykum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. So the answer should be equal to what he has said. So the prayer that he has made for us, we must make the same prayers for them, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on July 27, 2022.
When I said there were people who stood up firmly against arrows and swords, but they were struck down when it came to suspicions and doubts, worldly greed is somewhat involved in this. This should also be taken into consideration. What world or dunya do we mean? Each person's world or dunya is different. One person's dunya is their wealth. Someone else's dunya is their position. Another person's dunya is their lusts. Different people have different worlds, dunyas, and these are all considered to be worldly desires. People may try to justify these desires, but they are still worldly greed. These also play a part. So, as I said, the Friday prayer sermons should be fundamental and focused on presenting rich content and strong logic concerning the essential issues of the revolution, such as justice. Justice is a very important issue. Think about it, work on it, speak about it. Also speak about independence. Independence is a very important matter. The issues of supporting the underprivileged and uniting the world of Islam are also very significant issues. Give people awareness and insight.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
These things that I have mentioned are also true for the upcoming Muharram sermons, and you should be able to see the results in the following Friday prayers. So, if what you're doing is successful, you should be able to see it in the people coming to the Friday prayers. If you notice that what you're doing was not effective in attracting a larger audience, there is something wrong with what you're doing. Find those flaws and fix them. We cannot say the reason for this lack of attention is that people have lost their beliefs and have become less religious. Some people say such things. It truly seems they are talking without having thought about what they're saying and are suggesting that the people have become less religious. No, that's not the case at all. They're not less religious. Just look at the Ghadir celebrations and the massive gatherings for the ceremonies and speeches during the months of Muharram and Safar. Who are the people who attend these ceremonies? They are our people. Look at the morning ceremonies, the religious ceremonies, the Arba'in Wukh. Who are these people? These are our people.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. You've done.
in the limelight.
Now, 18 months into his presidency, Biden has to claim those Trump positions as his own. Consistency, not reversal, describes his West Asia policy. The fist bump was the least of it, says Phyllis Penny's author in an article published under the heading, "The fist bump was bad, but Biden's West Asia policies are worse." Stay tuned for the details, please. President Biden's fist bump with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and the president's up-close and personal handshake with former Israeli regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu sparked outrage and cries of hypocrisy from human rights activists, supporters of Palestinian rights, and defenders of democracy. MBS is, after all, responsible for the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi and the war that has devastated Yemenis. Netanyahu, currently on trial for multiple corruption charges, presided for a dozen years over Israeli regime's apartheid system, settlement expansion, war crimes in Gaza, and the murders of several journalists even before Shirin Abu Akleh was killed in May. Outrage was absolutely called for. Symbolism is important, but the fist bump and the handshake were the least of it. Biden's first presidential trip to the West Asia region had a lot to do with consolidating U.S. power and countering Chinese and Russian influence there, strengthening the Israeli and Saudi-led coalition under U.S. leadership and increasing arms sales. The timing had a lot to do with the war in Ukraine and the price of oil at home, with global shortages and price hikes linked to the war-driven sanctions against Russian crude. Biden's trip had a message for all of that. MBS and the Zionist leadership have been eager to reaffirm their tight partnerships with the U.S., following their strategically consistent but symbolically extreme embrace by Trump. Biden's greetings made clear that consistency was indeed his agenda, and that apartheid, war crimes, and murder of journalists would pose no barriers to those special ties between Washington and its favored West Asia allies. But far more consequential were the actions, what Biden did and didn't do during his meetings. He did reaffirm the strategic ties with both Saudi Arabia and the Zionist regime, making clear that human rights concerns, even if mentioned, would have no impact on actual relations and, crucially, no impact on billions of dollars in military aid and arms sales. He did reiterate the pride of place that both the Israeli regime and Saudi Arabia hold in the U.S. government's West Asia policy, their bilateral ties with Washington and their no longer secret ties with each other remain at the center of the U.S. strategy to continue as the dominant global power in the region. The president did say the right words, that human rights matter, that he believes Mohammed bin Salman is indeed responsible for the murder of Khashoggi, and that he still supports equal measures of freedom, security, prosperity, and democracy for Palestinians and Israelis. But what didn't Biden do? He did not condition military sales to Saudi Arabia on ending the war against Yemen despite the Arms Export Control Act's requirement that U.S.-provided arms be used for internal security or for legitimate self-defense. Like all his predecessors, he did not demand that U.S. military aid be conditioned on the Israeli regime, ending any of its specific human rights violations that keep equality but out of reach for Palestinians. He did not announce plans to cut that military assistance, even though the Lehi Law prohibits aid to any military unit that has committed a gross violation of human rights. And the U.S. admits the Israeli regime military was likely responsible for killing Shirin Abu Aghila. Despite his public assertions about human rights, Biden did not announce or make any moves to actually hold either of these key U.S. allies to account for their violations. When Biden chose Saudi Arabia for his first visit to the region as president, the regime was thrilled seeing the trip as a chance to reclaim its primacy as Washington's favorite Arab country. What MBS wanted was indeed primarily symbolic, a handshake, or in this case, the notorious fist bump, a globally televised reminder of his stature meeting the U.S. president was an equal. He wanted the return to normal optics for U.S.-Saudi ties after Biden's campaign pledged to treat Saudi Arabia as a pariah. The crown prince got all that, but he also wanted some other things way beyond the symbolic level. He wanted continued arms deals, U.S. backing for Saudi Arabia's military dominance as the top U.S. proxy in the Arab world, and a clear grant of impunity for human rights violations, whether war crimes against Yemeni civilians or the assassination of a U.S. resident journalist in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. And he got all that too. Biden claimed he pushed back, telling MBS directly that he believed the prince was responsible for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Then he left it there and turned to business as usual. He could have gone on to say, "And because we hold you responsible for that murder, and because you are largely responsible for the worst humanitarian catastrophe in the world today, the war in Yemen, we are not selling you any more arms until there is some kind of real accountability." In fact, Biden said nothing of the kind. His only apparent request not made publicly was for Riyadh to increase oil production levels to help replace Russian oil and lower global and U.S. fuel prices. What if, rather than urging more oil production, Biden had told MBS that the U.S. instead planned to help provide Europe with massive economic support for a fast transition to sustainable energy to replace its dependence on fossil fuels? And it turns out Saudi Arabia has just doubled its imports of cheap Russian oil at sanctions-reduced rates for domestic use, so it can sell its own crude on the global market at today's sky-high market prices. Overall, the joint declaration celebrates the unshakable U.S. commitment to Israeli regime security. It includes Washington's guarantee of the Zionist regime's qualitative military edge and pledges to preserve and strengthen Israeli regime's capability to deter its enemies and to defend itself against any threat or combination of threats, as they say. And the declaration even promises more military aid beyond the current level of $3.8 billion every year. While that commitment is not so unusual, the declaration then adds something not so commonly found in diplomatic documents, the claim that all those U.S. commitments are sacrosanct. That's a word rarely used to describe political positions. Merriam-Webster defines sacrosanct as holy or immune from criticism. Given the criticism from human rights defenders, Palestinian rights organizers, and anti-war activists that has followed Biden's trip to the region, the notion that continuing U.S. military aid and protection of Israeli regime apartheid will somehow remain immune from criticism seems like wishful thinking on the part of the White House. There were other points of clear agreement. Biden and his Israeli counterparts signed off on an attack on the Palestinian-led BDS, that is, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, promising to combat all efforts to boycott or delegitimize Israeli regime and to protect this regime at the United Nations and the International Criminal Court. And they agreed to allow all Israelis to enter the United States under the supposedly reciprocal visa waiver program, despite the Zionist regime's refusal to allow all U.S. citizens the same privilege. In fact, the U.S. State Department's own advisory warns that U.S. citizens of Arab or Muslim heritage, including Palestinian Americans, have experienced significant difficulties and unequal and occasionally hostile treatment at the occupied territories, borders, and checkpoints by Israelis. In 2017, Donald Trump went to Saudi Arabia, where he signed an arms deal worth billions. In 2018, he announced a set of new U.S. policies towards the Zionist regime, moving the embassy to Al-Quds, recognizing Israel's annexation of the Syrian Golan Heights, and declaring the Jews-only settlements across the West Bank and East Al-Quds to be legal. Biden didn't ever agree with the Trump administration's position on the Israeli regime, and he called Saudi Arabia a pariah. He could have reversed Trump's policies on day one in the White House. But now, 18 months into his presidency, Biden has to claim those Trump positions as his own. Consistency, not reversal, describes his West Asia policy. The first bump was the least of it.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahan Abbott, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has arrived in Pakistan to see climate-induced devastation from months of deadly record floods that have left half a million people living in tents under the open sky and have left nearly 1,400 deaths. During his visit, the UN chief and Pakistan's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif discussed the latest situation in the country. The two focused on joint efforts to carry out relief, rescue, and rehabilitation at the international level to mitigate the sufferings of the flood-affected people. Later, the visiting UN chief also met Pakistan's foreign minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari and assured him of every support possible. The UN Secretary General, who has launched a global appeal to raise $160 million in flood assistance for Pakistan, says Pakistan is one of the countries most affected by climate change in recent months.
Developed countries must step up and provide Pakistan and other countries on the front lines with the financial and technical resources they need to survive extreme weather events like these deadly floods.
Bhutto said that his government is trying its best to help people who had lost everything in floods, but international help would be required to overcome the catastrophe.
I cannot shelter 33 million families. I cannot provide the food and clothing for 35 million families. We don't have the infrastructure in place. And this is just the rescue and relief phase.
The UN chief will travel to areas most impacted by the climate catastrophe. He will interact with the displaced families and oversee the UN's humanitarian response and relief efforts for millions of affected people.
As the floods continue to ravage Pakistan, UN agencies and several countries continue to send aid to flood-affected people in recent weeks. However, Pakistani authorities believe that more assistance is required to help millions of flood victims. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
The annual report from one of France's top NGOs revealed that poverty has already skyrocketed this year. And that's at what many say is only the beginning of years of inflation and recession provoked by sanctions on Russia over the unrest in Ukraine. Secours Populaire found that the number of people who say they have known poverty has increased 9% in just the past year. That's the biggest increase in 30 years. This year, over 40% of France says they can't pay their transport, medical, energy, or childcare bills, or go on vacation, or even buy fruits and vegetables. It's the highest percentage they've ever recorded.
The poverty question in France is one that's been central, but the social safety net is running out. It's just going to get worse and worse for the poor people, because they're not going to be able to afford this stuff, you know? And the French are not going to be able to subsidize these cost of living increases the way they did.
The steep increase in poverty comes after a decade of failed austerity policies and a deep devaluing of the euro currency. The government just announced they expect the next two economic quarters to produce a growth rate of 0.2% and then 0%. Many predict that the essentially recession-level economy will soon begin massive layoffs. That combination spells stagflation, and it's something for which liberal economics has no theoretical remedy. This adds to the feeling of unease, especially among the investor class and high finance.
France has a pretty good record of having a social safety net for those who are on bottom as far as health care is concerned and other basic necessities. But since Macron got elected, a lot of those things have changed because Macron has decided that he's going to attack that social safety net.
The report showed that a near universal 85% of France is worried for the future generations. That's also the highest percentage ever recorded. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A rally has been held in the besieged Gaza Strip to show support for Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds against the growing Israeli aggressions. Protesters have chanted slogans against the Israeli regime and called for an end to the Israeli occupation. Tensions have soared in Al-Quds in recent weeks as extremist Israeli settlers backed by Israeli forces desecrated Al-Aqsa Mosque. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned the Israeli regime against committing violations in Al-Quds.
The Zionist enemy must understand that violating the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque will not be tolerated by the Palestinians.